Authorities in New Zealand are not certain how many people might be involved in attacks against Muslim worshippers and are warning residents to avoid going to mosque anywhere in the country. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says there was carnage at two mosques in Christchurch.
This is one of New Zealand's darkest days.
She says many of the victims appear to be migrants seeking safety in the country.
They are us. The person who has perpetuated this violence against us is not.
This witness at one of the mosques that was attacked says there was blood everywhere.
Praying to God, oh God, please, now let this guy run out of bullets.
Witnesses say they heard dozens of shots and then people screaming as they ran out in terror. Residents were helping victims in the street as they waited for emergency responders to arrive. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The U.S. Senate voted to reject U.S. President Donald Trump's national emergency declaration to fund border wall construction. As AP's Sagar Magani reports, 12 Senate Republicans ignored a presidential veto threat and joined a unified Democratic caucus to pass the disapproval measure in the Republican-led chamber.
There were references to high school civics class and Schoolhouse Rock.
For me, this is a constitutional question.
Congress, not the president, has the sole authority to determine how to spend taxpayer money.
This check on the executive is a source of our freedom.
Mitt Romney, Rob Portman, and Lamar Alexander, among a dozen Republicans, voting to block the president's move.
The legal scholars all say it's totally constitutional.
He's promising a veto, and it's nearly certain there will not be enough votes for an override. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Hundreds of people surrendered to U.S.-backed forces for the second day in a row as the last remnants of the Islamic State group fought to hold the Syrian village of Baghouz. Officials say that 1,300 people surrendered to Syrian Democratic Forces, bringing the total number of people to leave Baghouz since the SDF resumed its final assault to more than 4,000. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan told the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee that the fight is almost over.
79-member Defeat ISIS coalition has liberated virtually all of the territory ISIS once held. As the U.S. drawdown continues, we will maintain a presence to prevent ISIS resurgence.
Fighting on the outskirts of Baghouz has been intense, with coalition airstrikes and artillery rounds lighting up the night sky, while IS fighters launched several waves of suicide bombers at the advancing SDF troops. The United Nations won almost $7 billion in aid pledges for Syria Thursday, overcoming fatigue among donors after 8 years of civil war and sidestepping divisions over how to deal with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. European Commissioner said that the participants in the donors' conference sent a strong message that a political solution could turn Syria into a stable, democratic, and prosperous country.
We must secure a better future for the people of Syria. We owe it to this generation of Syrians who suffer unfairly.
The European Union, the world's biggest donor, pledged 2 billion euros for this year, although that sum included money already agreed for Syrian refugees in Turkey under a deal with Ankara to take in the Syrians. British lawmakers voted Thursday to seek a three-month delay in Britain's scheduled March 29th split from the 28-nation European Union after overwhelmingly voting against holding a new Brexit referendum. We get more from AP's Ben Thomas.
British lawmakers have already rejected May's EU divorce deal twice, and if it fails a third time, May has warned Brexit supporters the only option will be to seek a longer extension. And that, she says, could mean Brexit never happens.
That is Ben Thomas reporting for the AP. Boeing announced Thursday that it is suspending deliveries of its 737 MAX jets to airlines after nearly every country grounded the plane following Sunday's deadly crash in Ethiopia. A Boeing spokesman said that we continue to build the 737 MAX airplanes while assessing how the situation, including potential capacity constraints, will impact our production system. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Malawi President Joyce Banda has withdrawn her candidacy in the May 21st election to enter into an alliance.
Malawians out there want change. And what we are wanting to see happening in this country is that we usher a new Malawi for our people. And a new Malawi cannot come with a divided front.
Maurice Mutale is the spokesman for the Malawi Congress Party. Governorship elections in six states in Nigeria remain inconclusive a week after the vote. Zimbabwe government suspends an NGO for allegedly encouraging protests. Angolans are cautiously optimistic about efforts to repatriate the country's stolen funds. And a Kenyan family mourns the death of a member in the Ethiopian Airlines crash.
The last time I saw my brother was a year ago when he came back from vacation. I spoke to him the night before he boarded the flight.
And the WHO wants to end DRC Ebola outbreak in 6 months. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's portion of our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Malawi Congress Party, the biggest opposition group in the country, says it plans to form an alliance with former President Joyce Banda's People's Party in the run-up to the upcoming May 21st elections. Banda formally withdrew her candidacy on Thursday to endorse Lazarus Chikwera, presidential candidate for the Malawi Congress Party. But former President Banda has been criticized for having no political loyalty to any particular ideology. She held talks early this year with Vice President Solos Chilima to form an alliance. Maurice Mutale is the spokesman for the Malawi Congress Party.
Indeed, we are in discussions with the People's Party of Dr. Joyce Banda. And actually, as we speak, there is a press conference organized in Lilongwe, a joint press conference between Malawi Congress Party and the People's Party. And the whole idea is to communicate to Malawians that we, Malawi Congress Party and the People's Party, are going to work together in an alliance towards the 21 May elections.
Realistically, what are your chances if you work together with the former president's party and his supporters for the elections?
You know, Malawians out there want change. And Malawians out there want a united nation. So one of the things that the Malawians would want to see is that parties are coming together for a common good. And what we are wanting to see happening in this country is that we usher a new Malawi for our people. And a new Malawi cannot come with a divided front. We are fighting a common battle with a common enemy. And we all want a transformed Malawi. And that's why we stand better chances of ousting this DPP government and ushering in a new Malawi.
But Maurice, some people are saying the former president cannot be trusted because a few weeks back, she was in discussion with Vice President Dr. Solos Chilima to form an alliance before the elections. She has abandoned that alliance and she is joining your party for the elections. Some people say she is not trustworthy. So why go into an alliance with somebody who is not politically loyal to one party or the other?
The Malawi Congress Party feels that the alliance between Dr. Joyce Banda's PP and the UTM had their own challenges, and we do not want to go into those challenges. What we know about Dr. Joyce Banda is that she is principled and that she was once the leader of this country, and we know what she did, and we have no doubt whatsoever that as she comes to work with us, what happened in their alliance is not going to happen with us because we are different. And we want to believe that there were reasons, and good reasons for that matter, that alliance flopped. So we are looking forward to working with Dr. Joyce Banda, not in the manner they agreed with the UTM, but in the manner we are going to agree with her.
But there are concerns that there are divisions within the rank and file of the MCP, the biggest opposition party in Malawi, and that gives incumbent President Peter Atta Mutharika the best chance to win re-election because of the divisions.
The Congress Party has got an open-door policy. We do not want to force people to come and work with us. But we feel those that we share same vision, those that we share the same aspirations, and we have the same objectives and goals, we want to work with us. So we do not want divisions in the opposition.
Maurice Umtali is a spokesman for the Malawi Congress Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Nzuzu. A week after Nigeria held governorship elections in 29 of its 36 states, the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, has declared inconclusive elections in six states, Bauchi, Adamawa, Plateau, Sokoto, Benue, and Kano. Coalition of votes from Rivers State has also been suspended due to widespread disruption and accusation of interference by some elements of the military. Rotimi Oyekayemi is the chief press secretary to INEC chairman Makmun Yakubu. He says a combination of factors contributed to the declaration of inconclusive elections in the six states, including the discontinuation of the use of the smart card reader, overvoting, and widespread disruption of the electoral process in many polling areas.
The returning officers in Adamawa, Bauchi, Benue, Kano, Plateau, and Sokoto states were unable to make returns, and so the elections were inconclusive, and there were various reasons. The reasons include mainly the discontinuation of the use of the smart card readers midway into the elections, or failure to deploy them, because according to our guidelines and regulations, the use of smart card readers is extremely important. It's compulsory. You must use them. Number two, overvoting. Number three, widespread disruption of the electoral process in many polling units. So these were the combination of factors that led to the situation where the returning officers could not make a return, and so the elections were declared inconclusive. The commission then decided that we will go back on the 23rd of March and conclude the elections in those six states. In the case of River State case is different because election in River was suspended due to violence. And when that suspension took place, what the commission did was to establish a fact-finding committee and give that committee 48 hours on the 10th of this month to go to Rivers and find out what happened. The committee returned to Abuja, and hopefully before the week runs out, the commission will consider the report of that committee and then announce the decision.
Rotimi, does this mean that the elections in these six states are going to be reorganized? Are you going to have new elections?
That's correct. We are going to have elections in affected areas in the six states. In other words, it may not be the entire local government, because the situation may not have affected all the local governments. So it is only those local governments where we had issues that we're going to go back and conclude the election.
Back to the situation you mentioned in Rivers State. Is the problem with the commission or the problem with the two political parties, meaning the PDP and the ruling APC? Is that the problem there in Rivers State?
The problem was the problem of violence. Now, when we conduct elections, we need a peaceful environment in order to be able to conduct this election. But what we found is that during the voting period, there were several attacks on our staff, on some polling units. Some of our electoral officers were abducted. There were gunshots everywhere. There was chaos all over the place. And the Electoral Act empowers INEC to suspend the election in the event of violence or even the threat of violence. In this case, it was like a war zone.
Rotimi Oyekayemi is the chief press secretary to Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission chairman, Makmun Yakubu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 15th. Daybreak Africa time now, 14 minutes past the hour. The Zimbabwe government has suspended a non-governmental organization for allegedly encouraging people to stage public protests earlier this year against the high cost of living. Masvingo District Administrator Ray Hovey suspended with immediate effect Community Tolerance and Reconciliation Development Trust, a youth organization that promotes democracy, development, and human rights issues. Hovey suspended the NGO pending investigations about the group's registration. Frank Guni is a ruling ZANU-PF activist. He spoke with Gabe Dube of View Zimbabwe Service from Washington.
I think in general, people have to understand that all non-governmental organizations exist in Zimbabwe to complement government efforts. So they have to abide by the rules and regulations. On the other hand, without passing judgment, what we understand is that this particular NGO is being suspected of having participated in influencing or encouraging people to demonstrate against the government in an illegal way, which resulted in loss of property and injuring of human beings in Masingo province and other parts of the country. However, until that has been proven to be the fact, I think operations of this NGO, just like any other non-governmental organization in Zimbabwe, should be allowed to go on because there are people downstream who benefit from their services. I think suspension should be ordered by the court rather than by an individual government official.
So now, looking at the way things are happening in Zimbabwe, this may shed some kind of bad light on the government of Mr. Emmerson Mnangagwa. So is this not a bad move, you know, taking into account that this is a new government that is trying to do better things?
Well, I think the bottom line is that all investigations must be done in a fair and impartial way. What should have happened is that the authorities in Masingo province should have referred this organization to law enforcement agencies who are equipped, who have the capacities to make a proper investigation. And if indeed this organization violated the provisions or the mandate of its operations, then it should have been sanctioned as required by the laws of Zimbabwe. But in this case, outright suspension is like summary dismissal without proper due course, and I think that's an issue that has to be addressed. On the other hand, I also believe that all non-government organizations, like I said before, they exist in order to complement the efforts of the government. They have to operate within parameters that are set out in the Private Voluntary Organizations Act of Zimbabwe. If they go outside their mandate and start engaging in, say, political activities, then they will be going outside the parameters of their operations.
Frank Guni is a ruling ZANU-PF activist. He spoke with Gibbs Dube of Viewers Zimbabwe Service from Washington. Angolans are expressing mixed views on whether or not President João Lourenço's efforts to repatriate suspected funds will pay off for the struggling oil-rich economy. Lourenço announced an amnesty last year to those who will bring back billions of dollars held illegally in foreign bank accounts. But while the president has been praised for a crackdown on corruption, it's not clear how much, if any, of the money has come back. Elizabeth Casimiro has more from the capital, Luanda.
Luzia Bento is one of thousands of sheet vendors in Praça da Madeira, an unlicensed market about a half-hour drive from downtown Luanda. Shikuba's construction materials business has been struggling since the price of oil, Angola's biggest export, dropped 4 years ago. Angola has since faced a shortage of foreign currency, which has discouraged banks from lending to businesses like Shikuba's. The government of President João Lourenço has been seeking to inject money into the country with an amnesty for those who repatriate suspect funds. But Shikuba has doubts that the program will help, at least for businesses like hers. The stolen money is for the tycoons who stole it, she says. But if money really returns, it would be useful if the government helps more business owners with loans to refinance and develop. Lourenço, who was elected in 2017, says decades of corruption under Angola's former president, José Eduardo dos Santos, left billions missing from state coffers. The former president denies any looting during his 38 years in power. He fell out with Lourenço after the president's much-lauded anti-corruption drive targeted members of dos Santos' family. Angolan lawmakers last year backed Lourenço on giving amnesty for those who bring illegally transferred funds back into the country. But so far, there's been no announcements on returned money, despite some high-profile arrests and prosecutions. Critics like opposition UNITA Party lawmaker Adalberto Costa Jr. says that raises doubts about the anti-corruption drive. He says it seems like this is a selective struggle. It is not a universal fight against corruption, says Junior. It seems like there are protected people and very calculated goals being pursued, he says. And a fight like this is not efficient. The Angolan Central Bank has cited billions of dollars over the years as having been illegally sent abroad, while tens of billions in government funds linked to Angola's state oil company, Sonangol, have disappeared. Lourenço sacked dos Santos' daughter, who was running Sonangol, and streamlined operations and regulations to encourage foreign investors. Lawyer Antonio Ventura is with the watchdog group Associação Paz, Justiça e Democracia. He notes it won't be so easy to eliminate systemic corruption and recover stolen funds after decades of exploitation. The process of recovering the money is not an easy task, he says. A lot of this money was put into financial assets, says Ventura, many of which are earning interest in foreign banks. However, he says, the fact that the Angolan Central Bank has made no announcement about how much it has recovered is an omission that indicates a violation of the right to inform citizens. U.S. officials on Tuesday praised Lorenzo's anti-corruption efforts ahead of a visit at the end of the week by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan. Sullivan will meet with the Angolan president to discuss global security issues. He'll also meet with the business community to underscore the importance of expanding economic and trade ties between the U.S. and Angola. Elizabeth Casimiro for VOA News, Luanda.
The World Health Organization chief says the Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo can be brought to an end in 6 months if everything goes as planned. Latest figures from the DRC Ministry of Health put the number of Ebola cases at 927, including 584 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus acknowledges any of the challenges that lie ahead could undo the gains achieved so far in controlling the spread of the Ebola virus. But he says enough progress has been made to believe the Ebola outbreak in Congo's North Kivu and Ituri provinces can be shut down in 6 months' time. He says transmission of the Ebola virus has been stopped in Beni, Mangina, Komanda, and Oicha in North Kivu province.
It hasn't spread to other parts of the country, and it hasn't spread to neighboring countries. I think anybody can agree that this is fact and something that we can say is good news. And the second is, not only that it's not spreading, it's actually contracting.
WHO reports the virus has been contained in 11 of the 28 communities affected by Ebola. Since January, it says the number of new cases reported every week has dropped by half from an average of 50 cases to 25.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Families from different parts of the world continue to mourn the deaths of their loved ones killed Sunday in the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302. 34-year-old Abdullahi Ibrahim was one of 32 Kenyans who perished on the Nairobi-bound flight. His family is still coming to terms with the death of their loved ones, Rael Ombuo reports.
A few hours before he boarded Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, Abdullahi Ibrahim chatted with his sister Aisha. Aisha had not seen her brother for close to a year and was excited about the reunion. The last time I saw my brother was a year ago when he came back from vacation. I spoke to him the night before he boarded the flight. He said that I should not tell the extended family that he was coming. He wanted it to be a surprise. 4 days later, mourners continued to visit Abdullahi's home in Nairobi's Kibera neighborhood. Abdullahi's family is now hoping they can at least bury their loved one. Abdullahi's uncle, Osman Abdullahi Taban, spoke to VOA.
The way I talked to my brother, I told him that even if a piece can be identified, it is good for him to come with it so that we can bury.
Sunday's crash was the deadliest aircraft accident in Ethiopian Airlines history. The plane, a Boeing 737 MAX 8, crashed just 6 minutes after takeoff near the Ethiopian town of Bishoftu, killing all 157 on board. 5 months earlier, another Boeing 737 MAX 8 crashed into the Java Sea off Indonesia, killing 189. Monday, Ethiopian Airlines regional manager Yilma Goshu announced the airline was grounding its MAX 8 fleet, a move followed by most other airlines and countries around the world.
But this does not mean that the incident was related with defects on this specific fleet. But we have taken this as an extra safety precaution.
The plane's flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder have been sent to Paris for detailed analysis. Meanwhile, Ethiopian Airlines on Tuesday flew 64 relatives of the victims to the crash site. Abdullahi's wife and father were among them. Their hopes of finding a piece of Abdullahi's body to bury are slim. On Wednesday, an airline spokesman said that no bodies were recovered from the crash site. It appears the force of the crash pulverized all the bodies. As Abdullahi's family continue to mourn, they hope they will find the closure they need, with or without his remains. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with a look at this weekend's fixtures in the CAF Champions League. Al Ahly and GS Saoura will battle for top spot in Group D of the CAF Champions League when they meet at the Borg Arab Stadium in Alexandria on Saturday. Egyptian giants Al Ahly will come into the match placed second on the log with 7 points and on course to reach the quarterfinals. This is despite them falling to a 1-0 defeat away to DR Congo Giants AS Vita in Kinshasa last weekend, with Tulisa Kisinda scoring a late goal for the Black Dolphins. In Group B, Horoya AC and Orlando Pirates will battle for a place in the quarterfinals when they meet at the Stade du 28 September in Conakry. The Guinean side are placed second on the Group B log with 7 points, while the South African visitors are third on 6 points. Elsewhere, ASEC Mimosa will chase an unlikely berth in the quarterfinals of the CAF Champions League when the FaZe hosts Lobi Stars at the Nnamdi Azikiwe Stadium in Enugu, Nigeria on Saturday. ASEC come into the match placed third on the Group A log, level on points with second place Wydad Casablanca, but ranked below the Moroccans on the head-to-head tiebreaker. Staying with football news, Black Stars head coach Kwesi Appiah has defended his call-up of three locally based players for the 2019 African qualifier against Kenya later this month. Kwesi Appiah's 24-man squad include Asante Kotoko's trio of Felix Allen, Amos Frimpong and Kwane Bontoro, all debutant for the national team clash at the Accra National Stadium.
I believe in promoting our local players. You see, not the players themselves. What happens is, once you bring a player to the national team, if even he doesn't kick a ball, the method is mixed up with our professionals, his confidence levels rises and they help our locally.
Elsewhere, Liberian national team coach Thomas Kojo has named a 20-man squad that will travel to Kinshasa to take on the Democratic Republic of Congo in the 2019 African Cup of Nations crucial encounter. Coach Kojo's team, released on Thursday, is made of dominant overseas players and a few locally based players. The Lone Star coach will also be missing former captain and star player Anthony Lafour. VOA reporter Moses Gazawu asked Coach Kojo what his selection will possibly look like.
Well, it's a mixture of local players and foreign players. I think we have 9 local players in the team, and then the rest of the players are the foreign-based players.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, March 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.